Welcome to Creation, Myth, or Miracle. This is your host, ex-atheist Richard Walker. Greetings once again. In order to continue countering some of the myths that exist in our culture, I want to introduce you to another creationist scientist. And I'm doing this for two reasons. One is because it's so often said there is no such thing as a creationist scientist, which is obviously a falsehood once you find out there really are such individuals. But secondly, because I want to share some information from an article that he recently wrote. Dr. Randy Guliusa is the national representative for the Institute of Creation Research. He holds a BS in engineering from the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology, a Bachelor of Arts in Theology from Moody Bible Institute. He's an MD, a doctor, has an MD from the University of Minnesota. He also has a Master's in Public Health from Harvard University. He served 9 years in the Naval Civil Engineering Corps and is a registered professional engineer. In 2008, he retired as Lieutenant Colonel from the United States Air Force, where he served as a flight surgeon and chief of aerospace medicine. And he's the author of a book titled Made in His Image, Examining the Complexities of the Human Body. Dr. Guliusa has participated in several scientific debates at secular universities and other places, and he makes both scientific and biblical presentations. What I'd like to talk about now is a very short article that he wrote titled Unmasking Evolution's Magic Words. And we're discussing this as part of our underlying theme here on this show, to pay close attention to the nature of the arguments presented in favor of evolution and against the notion that the Bible just might be true. The public is constantly told that the evidence against the biblical history is scientific and based upon cause and effect, and anybody reasonably intelligent and scientifically educated would clearly see that. Well, let's take a look at just how some arguments are actually presented in favor of evolution. Dr. Guliusa wrote, "Everyone certainly sees design in nature by observing the purpose of precisely fitted parts. Those in fish gills or bird wings, for instance, enable those animals to fit into their environments. Evolutionists, however, seek to suppress humans' natural tendency to link features of design to a real designer. They teach that complex animals only appear to be designed, and that what looks like intelligent crafting is only an illusion." Why not accept that evolutionary explanation? This is a fair question, but there's no need to jump right into a list of scientific problems raised by evolution. Instead, start with what is relevant to explaining design: the fact that evolutionary science is different from sciences that use natural, repeatable, and verifiable methods to explain phenomena. Evolution is fundamentally a historical narrative, a story, that attempts to reconstruct unseen past events. Many people find this story too weak to be a persuasive reason for design, since it is built on absolute chance and uses remarkably unscientific language within its explanations. Now, previously on this show, we've discussed the difference between origins science, such as creation or evolution, and laboratory science, which are those repeatable experiments that we can do in the lab today. Just remember that whenever an observation is made, that observation is made in the present. It is made now. Conclusions reached as to what may or may not have occurred in the past are inferences. They are not observations. So what we really should be doing, if we're interested in figuring out what most likely occurred in the past, is to examine the evidence we can observe in the present and seek the most reasonable explanation for that evidence. This is precisely the description of the process argued for by intelligent design advocates, for example. Well, what did Dr. Guliusa mean by the use of unscientific language within evolutionary explanations for the past? He continues, The term magic words is used here as a concise idiom that describes the best words evolutionists use to explain apparent design. Evolutionists confidently insist that a complex biological feature simply appeared, emerged, arose, gave rise to, burst onto the scene, evolved itself, derived, was on the way to becoming, radiated into, modified itself, became a miracle of evolution, was making the transition to, manufactured itself, evolution's way of dealing with, derived emergent properties, or was lucky. Now note, each of these phrases are quotes from actual articles that purport to be scientific. Guliuza continues, how do words like appeared explain design? Just like magic, the use of this word invokes mysterious powers within unseen universes that are capable of leaping over enormous scientific obstacles without having to provide any scientific consideration for how a particular physical result was achieved. Magic words convey wish-like convictions that if evolutionists just believe deeply enough, their explanations must be true and someday will be true, though currently resisted by all scientific evidence. Explaining design by believing it, quote, arose, appeals to imaginary special forces which help evolutionists to connect their evolutionary dots. But as in any magical kingdom, the connections are mental fantasies that are not grounded in reality. Magic words lack explanatory power because they fail to tie real observations to detailed descriptions of how features of design originate. Claiming that novel biological features, quote, burst onto the scene, abandons the need for experimental verification. Indeed, the implication is to not even try. Take any biological observation. In evolutionary thinking, any observation can be transformed into a proof that explains its own existence by applying the magical phrase, quote, it exists because it is favored by natural selection, end quote. In reality, observations are only observations and are neither proofs nor explanations. Engineers, medical doctors, and other scientists who rely on studies or experiments do not use these kinds of words. Their products do not emerge, but develop via thought-filled processes. They rightly call filling a knowledge gap with narrative stories arm-waving, which calls to mind a stage magician. In conversation with others, it would be difficult to overemphasize how important magic words are to evolutionary theory. Remark on how these words pervade elite journals like Science, popular magazines like Scientific American, and television shows like Nova. Magic words pour from evolutionary literature like water over Niagara Falls. Challenge your listener to carefully observe the communication in these forums, noting how many paragraphs or statements pass without the use of these words. They are the lifeblood of the evolutionary community's most profound and highest quality scientific literature. Dr. Guliuza has it absolutely right. On a previous episode, some of you may recall, we talked about the fact that evolutionists were actually encouraged by Eugenie Scott from NCSE, the National Center for Science Education, or National Center for Saving Evolution, which is how it really functions. But she said, whatever you do, if observations don't match the evolutionary theory, don't say that they contradict it. Rather say, this sheds new light. And as I mentioned on that broadcast, I did a Google search for the word evolution combined with the phrase sheds new light and achieved well over 2 million hits. So evolutionists obviously took Eugenie Scott's advice to heart and used that phrase all over the place. Now, regardless of whether or not a writer says that an observation sheds new light on that particular aspect of evolution, or just flat says it contradicts what we expected, that doesn't change the facts, does it? But it can change your perception of the theory itself. If you take such pronouncements by evolutionists at surface level and don't give them any thought at all, it sounds like everything fits with evolution theory. It just sheds new light on it, so we've learned more about evolution, haven't we? However, give it a bit of thought. If a theory is so flexible that an observation which contradicts what was expected can somehow fit into the theory, just how good is that theory? Apparently, when it makes predictions, it doesn't really matter if those predictions are falsified. So just how good is that as a scientific theory? So I encourage you to think about what is presented to you, whether it's from an evolutionist journal or from this broadcast. Okay, now that everybody's thinking about what they're hearing, let's go back to Dr. Guliusa's article. The next section is evolutionists insist chance alone produces design. People should be educated about the central, but cleverly de-emphasized, dogma of evolution, that complex design is wholly chance outcome of natural processes operating in a mindless, self-contained system that does not determine need or purpose in advance and sets no direction. Distinguished science historian Jacques Barzin described the key elements of evolution as, quote, the sum total of the accidents of life acting upon the sum total of the accidents of variation, end quote, leading to a, quote, completely mechanistic and material system. That is, one with no God. In 1995, the influential National Association of Biology Teachers crafted a definitive, quote, statement on the teaching of evolution that affirmed the centrality of chance. Their first tenet read, the diversity of life on Earth is the outcome of evolution, an unsupervised, impersonal, unpredictable, and natural process of temporal descent with genetic modification that is affected by natural selection, chance, historical contingencies, and changing environments, end quote. Please notice, for you theistic evolutionists out there, there is absolutely no place within this definition of evolution for God himself. However, the theistic evolutionists that I've had the opportunity to speak with don't seem to be bothered by this, because they seem to think God was only involved in igniting the Big Bang anyway. Which, of course, means they're stuck with all the scientific problems that evolution can't explain because they don't have a sufficient cause for the effect, since their God isn't involved. Back to the article we're reviewing. Newsweek summed up the view of Harvard's renowned paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould. Why did some lineages survive while most perished? There's no obvious reason, says Gould. The survivors were not simpler or more complex, more generalized or more specialized, more numerous or superior in any obvious way. The obvious answer, but one which most people instinctively resist, is that they were lucky. Not only is there instinctive resistance to this answer, but it is intellectually distasteful to credit blind luck for complex designs. People experientially know designers are, without exception, the real cause. Teachers of evolution, therefore, do not attempt to get people to swallow, in one big gulp, a single colossal chance explanation. Instead, they adroitly assert that what seems like a huge chance biological event is simply the cumulative effect of countless tiny lucky events arising over enormous time periods in primitive life forms' descendants. People relate readily to coincidental, almost happenstance events. If these are coupled to staggeringly long time scales, biological wonders that are intuitively impossible, well, might just happen. To counteract this thinking, offer a dose of reality. Point out that scientists never actually observe random DNA mistakes accumulating to generate from scratch the instructions necessary to build the type of complexity seen in biological structures. That is an absolutely accurate and very important observation. I mean, think about it. evolution requires that random, that is, undirected DNA mistakes do accumulate to generate all the information necessary from scratch. It wasn't there before. They have to generate the information necessary to build incredibly complex biological structures. That is absolutely fundamental to evolutionary theory. It not only must happen once in a while, it must have happened untold billions of times. And yet, we can't find a single observational example of that type of information arising by undirected means. And in fact, it isn't even theoretically possible if you examine the problem within the context of information theory. But nonetheless, we're simply assured that it has in fact happened. The proof? We're here. The bottom line is, the real logic is the following. There is no God, therefore, we must have evolved, independent of how difficult that looks scientifically. That's actually a statement of faith in an atheistic worldview, but that's truly the underlying logic here. Let's get back to Dr. Guliuza's article. Do major science journals overcome barriers to evolution by using jargon and magical concepts to hurdle them in a single bound? Yes, as typified in the Archives of Ophthalmology's account for the origin of the eye lens. Now keep in mind as I read this, this is actually in a published scientific article. Listen carefully to what they say and decide for yourself if they've done anything in explaining how a lens in an eye actually came to be. The article says, lenses in different species may originate from different tissues in the embryo, but no matter what the source tissue, the substance that makes up the lens body must show a graded difference in density, greater in the center with a resulting higher index of refraction, less dense in the periphery with a lower index of refraction. This has been evolution's way of dealing with spherical aberration, a particularly pressing problem. Now, how did evolution deal with it? The, quote, complex genetic programs were lying in wait, end quote, to build all eye structures, including the lens proteins, which were recruited via molecular opportunism to perform totally new functions since, quote, evolution uses what is available. It is a consummate recycler. Well, does that sound like a really satisfying explanation to you? Consider their statement, complex genetic programs were lying in wait. I see this all the time. They basically say, well, we don't really have to produce that complex information. It was already there. Wait a minute. You're supposed to be explaining the origin of it. It's sort of like if I said I'm going to tell you the origin of the automobile, and I then tell you I go down to a dealership and buy one. It was lying in wait. Have I explained to you the origin of an automobile? Well, let's get back to the subject at hand, the lenses in an eye. Dr. Guliuza describes some of the features necessary for these lenses to work correctly. He writes, the graded density of lens proteins, a great design feature, overcomes spherical aberration by allowing light entering through any spot of the lens to focus to a clear point, a single point. You get good vision, rather than many points, which is poor vision. Evolutionists should also consider that lens proteins just happen to be shaped and arranged to allow the lens to change profile to focus images from near or far, providing it is suspended precisely behind the pupil by hundreds of surrounding ligaments attached on one end to a special lens capsule and the other end to a circular muscle anchored to the retina. Indeed, hundreds of other design features could be listed, which are better explained as resulting from a real designer. So as I hope is obvious to you if you're actually thinking about this at all, the supposed explanation given in the journal article explained nothing. It really amounts to a statement of faith by the author of the article and the editor of the journal, by implication, that evolution somehow made this happen. And so they assert to you that it did. but they don't tell you in any way actual cause and effect. How did a lens originate? If you read biological evolutionary literature or you're a student of biology and you encounter this in classes, listen closely and look at the arguments presented. See if they ever really tell you the actual origin of the genetic information for producing any of these complex structures. And by origin, I do not mean it was already there lying in wait. If that's true, it already existed and you haven't explained the origin. I mean, let's get real here. See, I don't think students are that stupid that they fall for these types of discussions. Which explains why there is so much oppression to keep intelligent design arguments out of the classroom. We'll talk about that on our next show. Dr. Guliuza sums this up. He writes, a quick response to a question of why evolution is not a satisfactory explanation for design might be, I've been less than persuaded by what I was taught in school and on educational programs. Leading evolutionists insist that the mutational mechanism of evolution is random with respect to any goal. I have never observed a process driven by chance, which absolutely excludes intelligent oversight, to produce features of design. From what I read and see on TV, evolutionists jump over details by using magical words like arose, appeared, give rise to, and evolved itself to explain how chance produces design. Even the leading journal for eye doctors recently used those words to describe eye evolution. The engineering feats I see are always the result of real designers, so I enjoy being free from the need to rely on the vague, non-scientific words evolutionists use. This explains why evolution, as only a historical narrative, is different from other types of science that use real experiments. I find it hard to substitute stories for direct observations. I also enjoy freedom from being forced to call design an illusion, a poor reason simply because it excludes divine intervention. And I like how Dr. Guliuza concludes his short article. He wrote, by helping people understand the best explanation for the origin of design, they can be influenced to see Christ as their creator, just as the Bible says, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Romans 1:20. As we finish today's show, let me remind you that Richard Dawkins began The Blind Watchmaker by acknowledging that, quote, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And furthermore, Francis Crick said in his memoirs that biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Why do they have to constantly keep that in mind? Because it looks designed. Well, perhaps both life and the universe itself look designed for a purpose because they are. The biblical account of creation makes it very clear that the world we live in was designed for a purpose. However, it also makes it very clear that this world is now affected by sin and is no longer identical to the way that it was designed originally. It's important to keep that in mind when you encounter the arguments that, well, yes, I see design there, but it's very poor design, and hence it's an argument against the notion that God designed it. The argument of bad design is often made. Most often, what they're talking about actually exhibits exquisite design when you look more closely. We'll talk about the design of the eye. This is a great example of that. In the meantime, just think about the possibility that your eyes and intelligence aren't fooling you. That when you look at things that appear designed, they really are. A creationist doesn't have to try to make up stories to hurdle over scientific difficulties. Those actually arise because an evolutionist has a problem. They're trying to make a coherent explanation of life and the world from naturalism, and that is simply impossible. See creationmythormiracle.com for more information.